part of free speech, the First Amendment.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a lot of assaults upon the First Amendment, and but tonight we're talking specifically about the Patriot Act, and I just hope you listen to the rest of the radio show here, but we do need to move on here. But thank you for your call in.
Hey, Tom?
Yes.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. You know, if our push, you know, and our entire push is about the USA Patriot Act, but if the city council who you know, put the teeth back into the resolution and actually listen to what we have to say, you know, we'll have to look at all these other issues. But I mean, there are definitely you know, it's been suggested there's some hypocrisy. Okay, with the, I mean, I was against the ordinances going in to begin with. Mm-hmm. I'm against more laws. We have way too many freaking laws, all right, in this country. You cannot live in a free country with so many laws.
Well, it just, you know, basically comes down to Bill of Rights is being insulted,
right,
on many levels.
Yeah.
By
and the last caller, it was, I would agree with him, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And definitely, you know, but right now, you know, hopefully he's listening, but, you know, right now I would suggest that, you know, this is so important, because this stuff, if this goes away, he has no chance whatsoever of getting the city council to ever, you know, kind of pull back on their ordinances.
Right.
But that, you know, at some point, though, that, you know, once, if we can get the big issue resolved, that would be, you know, then we could, like, kind of call them on their smaller stuff,
right,
which is not small to the people that it's being, that are having to deal with it. But anyway, so I just want him to know that, you know.
Right,
we,
right.
We would, yeah.
Well, as I say, there's lots of problems out,
yep,
there, and
absolutely,
what I often say to folks, you know, there's you could spend from the time you lift your head off the pillow in the morning till, yep, the time you put it at night, just addressing problems and what to do. And I say, whatever's bothering you the most, what really gets to you, that is your message from out there, if you will, to take some action. And you've taken action on a very vital, essential topic here.
Well, this is the foundation of our, you know, of our freedom. You know, the freedom that when people say, look, you know, if you don't like it here, you know, you're able to speak out, so shut the hell up, you know. Now, it's in other countries, you can't speak out, so shut up, is essentially what they're telling me. You know, they're saying love it or leave it or what, you know. It's like this, the bedrock, the foundation of our freedom is the Constitution and its Bill of Rights.
Well, John, we have about 45 seconds here, so if you,
okay,
could just tell people where the meeting's to be and,
yes,
how to get a hold of you.
Absolutely. Santa Cruz Library downtown, the main library. It will be June 30th at 5 o'clock. We booked the place till 7 o'clock, so we got 2 hours. And that's where it's at. And my number, again, is 419-3190, if anyone wants to call and get more
one
information.
One more time.
Yeah, 419-3190. And we're looking for, you know, our goal is to, you know, one of our goals is to get everybody in Santa Cruz aware of what's going on, you know, with this Patriot Act. So,
John, I want to thank you very much for an excellent show. I think you certainly conveyed a lot of information. So we'll do this again.
Tom, thank you very much for inviting me. Okay.
Well.
Good night.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls at least for a few minutes until maybe 20 minutes or so after the hour till we take the first break. And then, of course, we welcome your calls. With us this evening is David Whitney, and we're going to be talking about the Institute of the Constitution. Now, a lot of people feel that the discussion of America's past are really not very pertinent to where we are today. After all, the Constitution is a living document that changes and certainly evolves with time, or does it? Is the Constitution a fixed document upon which the very foundation of our society rests? Is the Constitution worth preserving, or does it need to be modified to bring it in line with the events of the 20th century? Well, of course, I happen to believe that the Constitution is a unique document that separated America from all the other nations of the world throughout all recorded time, and was the reason that for so many years America was looked upon as the city on the hill, the beacon of light, the hope of all mankind, the last best hope of all mankind, and why, of course, America is failing and the world is moving towards chaos. Because we've abandoned this wonderful document that was given to us from generations past and which has allowed us to have the greatest degree of personal freedom of any society ever. Now, this isn't to say America is perfect because mankind isn't perfect. But, of course, the founding fathers of this country recognized man's inherent evil nature and therefore set out to create a system of government that would bind the people down, but bind the politicians down with the chains of the Constitution to take the chains off of people, because it's government that has always depressed people down through the ages, take the chains off the people and put them onto the politicians. How far we've come from that to where we are today. Well, of course, the Institute of the Constitution is aimed at actually rekindling that spark of freedom, that understanding of freedom that once burned so brightly in the hearts of the American people. And to discuss the Institute is David Whitney. David, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's a privilege to be on your show, and I appreciate the great work that you're doing all over our land, because you're absolutely right. What needs to take place is a rekindling in the hearts and minds of people to take us back to what our founders gave us, a tremendous document that assured our liberty, provided people applied that document. And of course, what's taken place is those who want to destroy the great constitutional republic created by our founders, what they had to do is remove people from understanding that document and implementing that document. And, you know, they have been wildly successful, perhaps more than they even intended to be. They have been wildly successful because most people have bought the lie that, you know, the Constitution is not a fixed document. It's this living, breathing kind of thing. You know, but most people, when it comes down to practical issues in life, don't believe that about other documents. For instance, if you enter a contract with a bank for a mortgage on your home, is that a living, breathing document? And you decide one month, you know, I think I'm paying too much, and we're going to change the amount that I pay. You think the bank is going to come back and say, well, that's fine, it's a living, breathing document, and we'll go along with the changes. No way. They will take your house right out from under you in a heartbeat. So the theory that people hold to really is a lie that has been believed, unfortunately, by so many people. And I'm excited to be working with Institute on the Constitution, because we are seeking to educate Americans of all parts of the country from all sorts of backgrounds as to the true intention of the Constitution as it was framed by our founders. And if they understand that, they will be equipped to say, wait a minute, there's so many things going wrong, there's so many things off base, we need to take our nation back. We need to take it back from the leftists who basically do not want to have liberty, do not want to have freedom. They want to have power concentrated in the hands of the few, and the rest of us, as you well stated, in chains, in subservience to them and obedience to them. It's interesting to see what's happening in the news. Just yesterday, our Supreme Court handed down some decisions about affirmative action, and kind of a mixed message, as best I can take, what they have communicated. But the Supreme Court has become far too important in our country because people have not understood their role in our constitutional republic. And, for example, the big battle going on in the Senate about the confirmation of the judicial nominees put forward, an unprecedented thing taking place where they're filibustering and preventing good nominees from actually being put into the position of circuit court judges and so forth. For example, Priscilla Owens, after 753 days, is still waiting. Charles Pickering is expected to be the next filibuster victim as well. Miguel Estrada has been waiting 753 days, and Jeffrey Sutton narrowly was confirmed after 720 days. This is kind of unprecedented thing that's taking place. Why is it so important to those senators to prevent conservative, strict constructionists, that is, those who believe the words of the Constitution should be interpreted as written, as intended by our founders? Why is that so important? They realize that the power in our country has shifted. It's no longer in the presidency, primarily, nor is it in the Congress or Senate. It is primarily in the hand of the judges. And we have what our founders feared. We have today what is clearly a judicial oligarchy. They have so much power in their hands as our founders never intended them to have.
And, of course, I think it's so vitally important that the American people really understand that America was founded as a Christian nation. Now, that is, of course, never mentioned today. The idea that America was a Christian nation, if anybody gets up and says that, he'll immediately be attacked by the media. Why is that? Why? Because the people who control the media hate Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly this is never taught in our schools, and even more frightening is they infiltrated our seminaries many years ago. And, of course, they have taught our ministers a lie. They've changed the meaning of the scriptures. They've changed the music of the church. But more than that, they have removed from the average minister the realization that he was to be the spokesman that was to keep America free.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you yourself are a minister.
Yes.
You've been to in training. What happened when you were in school? Did they teach you about the importance of America being a Christian nation and why America really was such a great nation?
Not at all. And that is a very, very unfortunate thing. I had to do a lot of studying on my own and a lot of reading on my own over the years to come to a clear understanding of the history of our nation that I was not taught. And matter of fact, the emphasis in most seminaries, including my own, was that Christian pastors really should not be involved in what was called politics. And I've been told many times as a pastor, you know, you speak about issues like abortion, you're speaking about politics, you speak about issues like homosexual rights or other things like that, you're getting involved in politics, pastor. You shouldn't be involved. You're a minister of the gospel and you should not be involved in politics. And I come back and say, wait a minute, did Jesus ever speak about the evils of his day? Oh yes, he certainly did. If you look very clearly in scripture, it is as plain as the text on the page that he spoke very pointedly and very powerfully to the evils of his day. That's what got him crucified. I mean, they hated to hear his message because he called the scribes and Pharisees whitewashed tombs and rebuked them for high interest rates and things like that. It's like, whoa, Jesus spoke very pointedly because those are not political issues, they are moral issues. And that's part of the trick of those who have sought to take Christianity out of the heart of our nation. They've tried to talk about everything in terms of politics, when really the scripture talks in terms of issues that are of right and wrong, of good and evil. And those issues should be spoken from the pulpit. As a matter of fact, the reason, and King George III knew this very clearly, the reason the War for Independence took place in the first place, because the pulpits of America flamed with righteousness, and the preachers of America were very clear in their criticisms of King George's disobediences to the law of God, and they enumerated them. As a matter of fact, they were so bold that they printed their sermons, and then they mailed them off to King George III to be certain that he read them and he knew exactly what they were saying against the evil that he was doing. Were they preaching politics? No, they were preaching the whole counsel of God, and that is one of the things that has been lost in our land, and that's one of the reasons why I became involved in the Institute on the Constitution, because it teaches the Christian foundations of our land and the Christian theology that really underlies our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, and then, of course, the Constitution. And as fascinating as Dr. John Einsmo takes a class through the Constitution, studying it article by article, clause by clause, he shows that Christian theology has informed each of the statements made and each of the decisions made. Our founders were not coming up with these ideas out of their own head or inventing them out of thin air. They were drawing on the Bible and Christian theology for formulating what they designed as our system of government. And they knew when they designed our system of government, it would not work unless the people of our land were moral and religious. Our second president, John Adams, who was heavily involved in all aspects of founding our nation, he said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It was wholly inadequate for the governance of any other.
Well, now, when Dr. Einsmo talks about the background of the Constitution, does he get at all into the Declaration of Independence and the relationship between the Declaration and the Constitution itself?
Oh, yes, he does, because he argues well, and I agree with him completely, that really the Declaration of Independence is the preamble to the Constitution. If you read the preamble to the Constitution, it is very brief. You know, it does not state the presuppositions, just states when in the course of human events, oops, I'm reading from the wrong document, hold on. Just we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It does not state its presuppositions, which is very critical, because if you don't understand the presuppositions underlying this document, you miss the whole import and direction of it. And therefore, the Declaration of Independence really is the preamble. We understand that we are created beings from the Declaration of Independence. We did not evolve. We were created. And God, who created us, has established laws. And His law is the only just law that exists. And every law of man is to be measured and evaluated against God's law, and when it's in disagreement with God's law, and when a ruler actually is in violation of God's law, that ruler can rightfully be deposed by the people under his power, which is why they declared themselves independent from King George III. They say he has forfeited his right to rule because he has violated the law of God. So if you don't understand the Declaration of Independence as the preamble to the Constitution, then you go way off track in misinterpreting what the Founding Fathers intended.
Well, I think that is so vitally important for people to understand that, of course, those words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and governments are instituted among men to protect those rights. And that's really what it's all about. Now, you know, I think that if people don't understand where we came from, they can't understand where we are today, and they certainly can't understand where we're going. There's an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy any mention of the Christian history of America. This is largely funded by the great tax-exempt foundations and by the people who've gained control of our media, the people who've gained control of our educational system, the people who've gained control of what the American people think. Now, it wasn't always that way. At one day, one time, everybody knew America was a Christian nation, and the vast majority of people in this country still espouse Christian principles. In fact, 95% of them, 93-95%, still believe in God. Now, the number may be shrinking slightly, but and I'm not saying all these people are Christians, but certainly well over 60% either espouse the Protestant or the Roman Catholic faith. So if we are really a democracy, how is it then that the Supreme Court could take God out of our schools? Well, Thomas Jefferson, and I keep next to my place where I work every day, a copy of The Master Thoughts of Thomas Jefferson, which was written in 1907. In other words, this is compiling what Jefferson had written. It was actually put together by the Bar of the State of New York. And this is what Thomas Jefferson wrote about our courts. "It has long been my opinion, and I have never shrunk from its expression, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of our federal judiciary. For an irresponsible body, for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisprudence, until all be usurped from the states and the government of all be consolidated into one. To this I am opposed, because when all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated." And he's talking about separated from the British crown. And why don't we teach this sort of thing in school? Why don't we teach the fact that the Supreme Court justices swear to uphold the Constitution, that their meetings start every day when the crier comes in and says, "God bless the United States and this august court," or this court? I mean, they can mention God in the Supreme Court, but we can't mention it in our schools. How could that be? Why, very simply, because they have put people onto that court specifically to destroy this nation. Yeah. And until the church is willing to speak out, till the people are willing to speak out and say, "We're not going to put up with this," things will continue as they are until eventually all freedom will be lost. And the liberty that we've known will simply become a remembrance of things past. Well, that's what the Institute of the Constitution is all about. Let me just mention for our listeners that there is a new institute. It's just going to be having its second meeting tomorrow evening. And those of you who would like to attend, it's going to be right there on close to the border between Spokane and Coeur d'Alene on the main highway there. Why don't you call Randall at 509-924-7080. That's Randall at 509-924-7080. And I know many of our listeners live up in the Spokane area. And call him and see about going, learning what it's all about. It doesn't cost you anything to go. And, of course, it could be a life-changing experience. Again, the number, Randall, is starting a new Institute of the Constitution. It'll be the second meeting, 509-924-7080. And if you're not going to get involved to save America now, who will? If not now, when? Well, now, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about what the Institute of the Constitution is before we go to our first break.
Yes, thank you. There's 12 series, a series of 12 lectures, half hour each, that Dr. John Eidsmo, a constitutional law professor at Faulkner University and a solid Christian who understands the Christian history as well as the importance of teaching that Christian history, he gives those 12 lectures. And following those lectures, we have a time of interaction where we review the materials and be certain that the concepts that he's presented in that half-hour lecture are solidified in the minds of each of the students who are part of the class. And then we have some time for discussion, usually some lively discussion and results, because people, as they begin to understand these principles, as they begin to see what's taking place in the daily newspaper and see how it relates, whether it's a decision by the Supreme Court or something going on in the Senate, they begin to realize, wait a minute, these people don't understand what we just learned. These people are missing the whole thing. And so it's an exciting process of education that we involve each of the students in an Institute on the Constitution.
And, of course, I think what's so important to realize is that the American people have been brainwashed. The average American believes we're a democracy, not understanding that we're a republic, and our founding fathers, the last thing they wanted was a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
The people do not understand that the people on the Supreme Court are violating their oath of office, that they can be limited in what they do very easily by imposing some of the restrictions that are in Article 3 of the Constitution. But then how many people really know what Article 3 of the Constitution is about?
Right.
How many people, if you're in the listening audience, how many articles on the Constitution? We'll cover that when we get back here at Radio Liberty in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest today is Pastor David Whitney, and we're talking about the Institute of the Constitution. We're talking about a program that's being set up all across America to rekindle that spark of patriotism that once burned so brightly in the hearts of every American. And every American understood the difference between a Republican and a democracy. Every American understood we did not want to have a democracy. So why, of course, does everybody think we're a democracy? Because they're able to control so effectively what the American people think. Well, let's go a little bit of now. Of course, you've told us that Dr. John Iadsmo gives 12 lectures, so there are 12 weeks that this program takes. And, of course, then there are a couple of programs after that by David Barton, aren't there?
That's correct. Actually, we incorporate a couple of David Barton's lectures into those 12 weeks. One of those is the excellent lecture he does on the myth of separation of church and state, which is a phrase that was twisted out of even Thomas Jefferson's original meaning and completely taken out of context. It doesn't appear in the Constitution, which is hilarious because David Barton quotes a particular senator who he was talking with, and the senator said, "Oh, well, that's in the Constitution." And David Barton took out a copy of the Constitution and said, "I'd be deeply obliged if you'd show me where the phrase wall of separation between church and state is in the Constitution." Said, "Oh, I know exactly where it is. It's right here in the First Amendment." And he read through the First Amendment, and the senator's eyes opened wide and said, "Well, it's not there." And David Barton said, "Well, why did you believe it was there?" He said, "Well, they always taught me that in law school." And you mean you never read the Constitution for yourself? And it's amazing that the people who are leading our country are woefully ignorant of the Constitution itself. I'm glad you quoted a little bit earlier Thomas Jefferson, because just a few years before he wrote what you quoted, he said, "The Constitution is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which may twist and shape it into any form they please." And that's the problem we have. If people don't understand the Constitution, they cannot hold our elected officials accountable to upholding the Constitution, and our elected officials are the ones who appoint the Supreme Court justices, who then further twist the Constitution out of sort. And so that issue of separation of church and state, David Barton does an excellent job destroying that myth and showing how it was never intended by Thomas Jefferson or any of the other founding fathers to prevent Christianity from speaking in the public in the public square, and actually speaking to the issues of the day. Rather, the Constitution prevents the government from interfering in the well-being and life of the church.
And of course, I think
exactly what we have taking place today.
Well, what people have to understand is that what the First Amendment says is that Congress will make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And then it goes on to talk about freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, but Congress will make no law. Well, of course, to get around this, of course, in 1946, I guess it was, somewhere there, 46, 47, then they took that the 14th Amendment, they twisted the meaning totally different than the meaning that was given to it by the people who voted on it, and they misused words, to actually put forward ideas that were never intended in the 14th Amendment, and to apply the same restrictions that apply to the federal government to the state government. And that's why they say, well, anything financed by the state, you can't have God mentioned. Now, it's all right to preach witchcraft in the schools, to read Harry Potter books. It's all right to advocate paganism. It's all right to advocate atheism. It's all right to advocate evolution. But don't you ever mention that man was created by God. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we invite your calls now. If you're out across America, you agree, you disagree, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please, give us a call if you have a question. Maybe you disagree. Maybe you believe that America is a secular nation. This is what you've been taught. There's no mention of God in the Constitution. There's no reference to this being a Christian nation. And of course, what about the other people who are not Christians? Don't they have any rights? Why should we simply preach one religion and not the other? Well, of course, where we've got to today, it's all right to preach the gospel according to Harry Potter in our schools, which is actually a means of introducing our children to witchcraft. And for those of you who do not know, of course, they released the fifth edition, the fifth in the series of Harry Potter books on midnight of June the 21st, of June the 21st. Why did they pick at midnight of June the 21st to release the book? Why? Because, of course, that is the beginning of the summer solstice, a high holiday for every witch and Satanist and demon worshiper in the world. They all understand that. But, of course, they figure that the average American is too dumb to understand that. And, of course, it's like Earth Day. Earth Day is Lenin's birthday. They all understand that. Yeah. But they laugh at how foolish and stupid the average American is. Well, let's go to Neil, who's calling from Kennewick, Washington. Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Dan. I'd like your guest to comment on Pat Buchanan. I supported him and voted for him in the presidential election. And I recall him saying, I may have misinterpreted him, but he said that the Constitution really did not provide for federal judges. That, and I kind of agree with him because in the history of it, these federal judges have caused more problems around the country than anything. But I'd like to have your guest comment on that.
All right, would you like to take that on? Because I don't know the answer to that.
That's an excellent question. Article 3 of the Constitution speaks to the judiciary and deals with all the elements of the judiciary. The only area of the judiciary it clearly states that must be established is the Supreme Court. In other words, the lower courts, the what we call the circuit courts and so forth, Congress can establish those circuit courts and is given the power to do that. And actually, Congress could abolish all circuit courts if it chose to do so and only have a Supreme Court and none other.
Okay, but then the rest of the courts would be the state courts,
that's
where
right.
the power was originally supposed to lie, not the with the federal government, mm-hmm. but with the state governments.
In other words, the Congress has a tremendous amount of power to check the judiciary, the federal judiciary. You mentioned earlier, Stan, that Congress could actually limit the power of decision-making of the Supreme Court, and it's right there in Article 3, Section 2, it says, in cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state may shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. And this is a very important distinction that Dr. John Eidmo brings out, because in most of the decisions the Supreme Court makes are really in that area of appellate jurisdiction. And it continues to say, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. In other words, Congress can limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. For example, a piece of legislation that is supposed to go to the president's desk shortly would ban partial birth abortion in our land completely. But everyone knows that as soon as the president's ink is dry on that piece of legislation, there will be a court case moving towards the Supreme Court to challenge the constitutionality of a ban on partial birth abortion.
But of course, the Congress could limit their appellate
exactly.
jurisdiction and do away with it. But there
they
are
don't.
Those. No, they don't.
They yeah. don't. And perhaps, and I'm not sure, and Eidmo points out very carefully that it's been more than 100 years since Congress has limited the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And the question is why? Two possibilities. One, that they understand that part of the Constitution, but they are of this ilk that really want to destroy our country, and therefore they do not want to do what would limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Or the second possibility is that they don't understand it because they don't understand the Constitution. And that's the purpose of the Institute on the Constitution, to train our people nationwide to understand every element of the Constitution.
Neil, do you have anything else you wanted to ask?
No, and then they're appointed for life, which is a pretty good deal for them.
Yeah, well, they could be impeached. That impeachment is a possibility, but it's very, very rarely been enacted.
Now, what we need is some people in Washington, D.C. who believe in the Constitution and are willing to impeach the judges, who swear an oath to uphold it and then progressively violent. Undermine it. God bless. Thanks so much, Colin Neal.
Thank
and
you.
We'll, of course, open up our calls to other lines, to other callers as soon as we get back right here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our special guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. David, I want you to tell our listeners how, of course, they can get in touch with you, how they can set up an Institute of the Constitution, how they can get started in this program, and when we have enough of these across America, when we have 10,000 of these across America, why this country is going to begin to change.
That's right.
More and more people... Go ahead.
Millions of people who understand the Constitution, it will be an irreversible force, and that's our goal, to see millions upon millions of American citizens who are going to take our nation back. And we've put together a host kit. We call it a host kit because you do not have to be a history major. You do not have to have a degree in law. You do not have to have any special expertise to host an institute on the Constitution, because Dr. John Eismoe does the basic teaching. He teaches from the history of our nation, as well as the history of the Constitution, and what each phrase and what each article means, and what each amendment means. So he does an excellent job of giving each person a working understanding of the Constitution and the Christian underpinnings for our Constitution. He does this, as I mentioned earlier, in 12 lectures, and so a person who would host this would receive a kit that contains all the lectures of Dr. John Eismoe on video, and then the lectures of David Barton on separation of church and state and the keys to good government that are incorporated in those 12 weeks. In addition to that, in their host notebook, they have an entire notebook that they can photocopy the parts that would be notebooks in the hands of each of the students in the class that would give them a thorough outline of each lecture. Following that would be a series of fill-in-the-blank questions that the host would walk them through, and of course, we give the host all the answers to those questions so they know exactly what they're doing, and they don't need to have any special knowledge or expertise on their own. They just have a desire to teach others the truth about our nation, the truth about the Founding Fathers, and what our Constitution is, a Christian document based upon Christian theology. And if they have a desire to do that, they can do that. I was talking this weekend with a gal who's in her mid-70s. So, you know, there's no age restriction here. She's in her mid-70s, and she's, for the first time this summer, is going to host an institute on the Constitution on the East Coast and is planning to do another later in the fall and is really excited about that. It's happening all over, and anyone can do this. So you need to call us at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. To order their copy of, or their host kit of Institute on the Constitution. We ask for a donation of $99, which just barely covers our cost to purchase the videos and put together the notebook and get all of that shipped out to them. We ask for a donation because we realize some people may be hosting their class and kind of asking their class to make a donation to be able to defray the cost of putting on the Institute on the Constitution, and we want to see this spread all over our land because we know this is the hope of taking our country back. There's so many people who are discouraged and kind of throwing up their hands and say, well, we can't do anything. It's too late. It is not too late. It is possible to take our nation back, but it begins by educating the people of our land with a clear understanding, the Christian underpinning of our nation and of our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I put together a 10-point program 3 or 4 years ago on what we could do to take America back. And the first point was have a personal relationship with the Lord, because you get involved in this battle and you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord, you're going to come under real personal attack and spiritual attack. But the second point was don't worry about, the point number two about the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, or the Masons. The most important thing you can do is know what America was all about. And I envision something just like you're doing, David, something like this Institute of the Constitution, to train people across America about our Christian heritage. And then the third, of course, was to understand what the bad guys are doing. And then the fourth, of course, was to get involved in educating others. And only through education are we going to be able to bring about any change. Now, it's vitally important that people understand that there has been an organized effort to prevent the truth from being taught in our schools. And my friend John Stormer tells about having had the opportunity of interviewing 100 lawyers. And he asked them, did you, when you went to the law school, ever read the Constitution of the United States? There were only two of them who did, and both of them happened to be students of the same law professor who'd been at Pat Robertson's Law School. That's Herb Titus. But they were the only two people, only two lawyers, who graduated from law school, who were experts in the Constitution, who had ever read the Constitution. Mm-hmm. In fact, as he said, Judge Roy Moore, who, of course, is the chief judge in the Supreme Court of Alabama, confided in John that he had never read the Constitution in law school. And only later, as people began talking to him about the Constitution, that he began to study it and become really an expert on it and realize the importance of the provisions in that document that guarantee our freedom. Now, people have to understand that everything going on is part of this conspiracy against God. Why is it, do you think, that they insist on teaching evolution in school, but not even mentioning the alternative, and that is God created the heavens and the earth? I think nothing wrong with people learning about evolution, but they have to realize it's all a lie. There is no evidence, absolutely no evidence at all, that the earth has been here for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 billion years, or that, of course, they just found out this new skull that's umpteen million years old. I mean, I'm old enough to remember all of the fraudulent Tilt-Down Man and Java Man and Pegging Man and Lucy, and they were all frauds.
Yeah.
But, of course, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. And, of course, all of this is an effort to disprove the opening chapters of the Bible, that God, in the beginning, God created the heaven and earth. So there is a conspiracy against God, and until people understand that, they can't understand anything going on. And you read Jeremiah 11:9, Ezekiel 22:25, you read the second Psalm, and there is a conspiracy against God. And we see this manifested in every aspect of our life on television, but we see it being enacted in our Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
We see it being enacted in our legislative halls, and it's about time we held our elected representatives responsible for the way they vote, and they may vote just the way we like them on guns and on abortion, but if they're doing everything they can to undermine the Constitution, why, they've got to understand that they're not going to remain in office. And most of the people certainly in Washington, D.C., aren't necessarily dedicated to the right or the left. They're dedicated to one thing, and that's staying in Washington, D.C.
Right. And that's the power that the citizens have, that basically if we throw them out of office and we put people in their place who do follow the Constitution, who do understand, then we can turn our nation around. And many people have said, well, that's not going to happen. You know, the fix is in kind of in the political system, and no one who really follows the Constitution can be elected. And that's a false assumption. The trick is, if you can keep enough people deceived, then yes, nothing will change. But you cannot do that if the education of people takes place where they really understand the Constitution. And we tell people in our class, you know, now that you've completed this study of Institute on the Constitution, you understand the Constitution better than 99% of the people in power, both in the state capital and in our nation's capital, because those people, as you mentioned, most of them go through law school, they never studied the Constitution there, and they get distorted and twisted ideas there that just are furthered by their political career. We need people who are fresh, people who really understand the Constitution, are willing to apply it irregardless of the consequences, because they're not career politicians. They're there to serve the country and to turn us back into the right path and away from the kind of leftist, Marxist, anti-God direction that our country has been heading and continues on at a very rapid pace.
You know, I think one of the most interesting things is that I think almost all of our state constitutions, and perhaps all of them, but almost all of them, you know, in the preamble to the state constitution mention God. Now, if that indeed is true, and even here in godless California where I live, if you read the state constitution, you'll find out it starts talking about God. So how can that be? Why, very, very simple. Because, of course, America was founded as a Christian nation. And our freedom came from God. Everybody knew that at one time. And isn't it amazing how in a few generations, by gaining control of the educational process and the media, and of course, intimidating and demonizing anybody who talked about Christianity and marginalizing them. And then, of course, what happened to Jimmy Swaggart and Jimmy Baker, didn't help matters at all. And then we've got some of our leading ministers, and every time they make a true statement, and then, of course, they're attacked by the media, they back down. I mean, that to me is unconscionable. Mm-hmm. And, I will have to say, I was so proud of Franklin Graham when he made a statement and he was attacked by the media, and he said, I'm not going to back down, I'm right. And of course then they left him alone, but the rest of them, they got a spine that would make a jellyfish envious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 464-8295. That's 464-8295, or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney, the Institute of the Constitution. Let's get that number out a couple
That's
of
right.
more times.
That's right. You can reach us at the Institute on the Constitution at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. And you can call that number and order a host kit, which will give you all the materials you need to put on an Institute on the Constitution, perhaps in your church. Churches would be the best place to start with this, but in your community center, or perhaps in your civic organization. I know many civic organizations like the Lions or Kiwanis or so forth have a plank in their purpose. Why they exist is to train their members in civics. And what are civics? If you really understand the Constitution, you've got a basic handle on it. And so this would be an excellent tool to take into organizations like that, or even a group of friends and family just gathering together in a home or a community center. There are many opportunities for this to be spread all over our nation. And our number at the Institute on the Constitution is 410-760-9068.
All right, let me just put another plug for the meeting that's going to be held tomorrow night. It's only the second in this a series of 12 meetings of the Institute of the Constitution to be held up there in the Spokane area. So call Randall at 509-924-7080. That's Randall at 509-924-7080. And if you have difficulty of reaching him, why, you can always give me a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And of course, we'll put you in touch with Randall, but you should be able to reach him at that number. So if you're up there in the state of Washington, consider very seriously going and joining a local Institute of the Constitution, get the training, and then set one up for yourself. And you can always use these tapes in more than one area. There's a That's book right. that comes with it, and I think, why don't you tell a little bit about the book? Because I think that, you know, a lot of people are sort of frightened. Well, gee, after I've shown the video, then what I'm going to say?
Mm-hmm. Yes, our notebook gives them a thorough step-by-step process of what they do after, how they introduce the video at the beginning of the session in the evening, and then following the playing the first half hour, which is the first lecture, second lecture, so on. Then the notebook gives them exactly what to do, that they can walk through a series of questions that they ask their class. Their class respond to those questions based upon what they just saw on the in the lecture. And the host has, of course, the answer key, so he knows what are the right answers. And as he walks them through that, as that ends, there's a series of discussion questions that can kind of get the people thinking about current issues and current ways in which what they have just heard make an impact on understanding what's taking place in our society as a whole. And then following that, of course, we have a way in which we encourage them to further interact the following week and prepare in getting their class prepared for the next week's lecture by handing out the notes a week ahead of time so people can read through them and be thinking about the issues that are going to be brought up in the lecture the following week. And so in the course of about an hour and a half time, these people become excited about the issues of what is taking place in our society that is misinterpreting the Constitution and misapplying the Constitution, and how we can return. And that's the other thing that Dr. Eismo does in the course of his lectures. He also shows us the ways in which we can regain, we can recapture, and take back our nation that has been taken over by the pagans and the atheistic secular humanists who hate God, as you have said, and want to destroy the Christian design that our nation has had for several hundred years at this point in time. Successfully, it's 700 years, and you look at all the atheistic, secular, humanist systems of government, USSR, for example, or Cuba right here to the south, and we see what a miserable failure they are. I have a friend who lives in Venezuela, and Venezuela is attempting to be another Cuba. And he has some property that he owns, and he's come to realize that the dictator of Venezuela, any moment he chooses, could walk onto his property and confiscate that property from him without any recourse on his part at all. It's a dictatorship. There's no freedom there. And that's what atheistic secular humanism produces when it's given full power, and that's what the atheists are attempting to accomplish here in our country.
And of course, they talk about socialism, and redistributing the wealth, but they're not going to redistribute their wealth because, remember, many of the people, now I'm not talking about the foot soldiers and this Marxist battle, I'm not talking about the members of the Communist Party who are working all across this country, and you're told communism is dead?
Mm.
Well, let me tell you, I get regular directives from the Communist Party talking about their political organizations right here in America. Why don't we hear about that? Because they've created in your mind the idea communism's dead, despite the fact there are 1.25 billion people living under communism in China today, and under communism in North Korea, and communism in Vietnam. Do you ever notice they never speak of communist China? Have you ever noticed that?
Mm.
Or communist Cuba, or communist Vietnam, or the fact that that Angola, that we support, is communist, or that Southwest Africa is communist, or that Rhodesia is communist, and that the communists are in working control of the ANC in South Africa. Why did they ever mention that? Because it's all perception. It's the use of words. That's how they control what the American people think. Well, let's go to Bill calling from Florida. Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Good to hear from you.
Good to talk with you, too. It's been a while. I wanted to ask the guest if they have a scaled-down version for people like myself that are disabled and can't hold the seminars to where we could watch the tapes.
All right, I don't know. What, how would you respond to Bill there?
That's a good question. Actually, you could just take the host kit for yourself and go through the host kit on your own, watching each of the lectures and following the notes. But I would encourage you to invite maybe one or two other people to join you, even if it's just in your living room or something like that, because the size of the class is not as critical as that we get a grassroots movement taking place of a groundswell of people all over the nation who understand the issues and understand what our founders intended to design when they put together our Constitution. So what we have in terms of the host kit can be done by as small a group as one person. If one person said, I really don't have an ability to bring other people together, but I want to go through this material myself, then that's fine as well. We would encourage people to do it in whatever way they can possibly handle that.
And Bill, remember, there's 5 videos, and then there's this big book, you know, they put everything together, all the questions and answers, and the transcripts of the talks. It's a great opportunity to learn about the Constitution. Anything else?
One other thing, the syllabus for your videotape.
Right.
Yes.
Is that available?
Yes, actually, the syllabus is the host, what we call the host notebook. It
host
includes
notebook.
A detailed outline of Dr. Eidsmo's lecture. So we encourage people basically to follow along that outline as they're listening to his lecture and perhaps add some other insights or notes that they see or points they pick up as they're going through the course of the lecture. But
Bill, why don't you call 410-760-9068? That's 410-760-9068. And just talk to him, okay?
Yes.
Okay.
We appreciate
you, Dr.
God bless you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Mike in Santa Cruz. We're out about time, but hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. You know, there are a lot of people in the audience who are pro-democracy or pro-socialist democracy.
Right.
And yet a lot of these people voice lots of complaints about the way our government is being run without knowing that the government is being run exactly the way they have wanted it to be run.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you or your guest could explain to them the difference between a constitutional republic and a democracy,
right,
or a socialist democracy.
You got 60 seconds, David. We're out of time.
Excellent question. You know,
you should have called in earlier, Mike.
That's right. A constitutional republic involves limited powers. The government does not have unlimited power. Government basically is under the law of God, and it cannot violate the law of God without being taken to task. A democracy puts the power in not God's hands, in the hands of people, and if you have 51% of the people agree to anything, then they can do it. 51% of the people decide that in Hitler's Nazi Germany that killing Jews is the thing to do, that becomes what they do. There is no check on the governmental power in a democracy. Someone has defined a democracy as three wolves and one lamb getting together to decide what they're going to have for lunch. And you know who loses in that vote. But a constitutional republic, some have said, is the opposite. It may be three wolves and a lamb getting together, but there's a law against eating lamb, and furthermore, the lamb is armed.
And I think that that's really what it's all about. I think that people have to understand that history records that democracies always end up in dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it happen? Because, of course, once the people find that they can vote themselves into the public trough and the wealth of other people, that they can get it simply by voting for it, they quit working, and, of course, then eventually they vote for more and more and more personal benefits, and then, of course, the country goes bankrupt, and it's replaced by a dictatorship. Now, if you go back and you read Plato's Republic, Plato said, and you'll find this quotation in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, democracies always deteriorate into despotism.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was a man named Andrew Tyler who, writing even before our Constitution was created, said democracies are temporary forms of government. They last mm-hmm. only until the people find they can vote themselves into the public a largesse, and then, of course, they deteriorate into dictatorship. Now, all you have to do is read the 10th of the Federalist Papers, where James Madison said, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are air incompatible with the rights of rights of personal property and personal liberty, and are usually as violent, short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. And that's, if you can't find that quotation, it's in my newsletter on the difference between republics and democracy. You can just pull those down off the internet, and we've got them all labeled there. But the discussion of republics and democracies there, I mean, everybody knows that democracy doesn't work until they dumb down the American people to the degree where they are today.
Right.
Why doesn't democracy work? Well, I'll tell you why. Because socialism is not a system of redistributing the wealth of the rich. It's a system of actually bringing the middle class under the control of the powerful. And, of course, this is why people of great wealth, the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Carnegies, have always been pushing socialism. Why? Because they know they can buy and sell the politicians. And, of course, once all power is in Washington, D.C., in the hands of the politicians, why, you will have the finest politicians that money can buy. How does that answer your question, Mike?
That's good enough, thanks.
Okay, thanks so much.
Yeah.
And I really think that Mike's point is so well taken. I mean, somebody told me that we were not a democracy 41 years ago, I said that couldn't be true. I mean, I graduated from the University of California. I minored in history. I had a Phi Beta Kappa key. Of course we were a democracy. And it was that realization that I'd been brainwashed that suddenly mm-hmm. changed my life forever. We've got Ron calling. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I have a question for your guest. I had read in the Article 3 that judges are to serve during periods of good behavior.
Yes.
And that the standards for impeachment are much lower. You could get rid of them a lot easier.
That's right.
And I mentioned that to my then-Senator, Slade Gorton. That was the first thing I talked about. I said I wanted 7 of the Supreme Court justices impeached.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my opening. It was a conversation starter.
I think I probably all right. Maybe 6 of them impeached, okay?
Yeah, maybe 6. I was probably wrong. I probably overstated my case.
Okay.
But he said that it's got to be during... You can only be impeached for... because of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Oh, he doesn't understand the Constitution, obviously. Where he hasn't read the Constitution.
That's what I said. I thought to myself, I said, I don't want to get in an argument with him. By the way, he's infinitely better than the other two senators we have today, Pulitzerian Patty Murray and Marxist Maria Cantwell.
Well, anyway, of course, your job is to help us educate the people up there in Washington, and certainly with, the American Freedom Network up there and these programs. If we can get enough institutes of the Constitution up in that area, we can take America.
That's
you
right.
can take Washington back. We got to do this one district at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And the more areas we can get the truth into, the more people begin to understand what's going on.
I work with the Boy Scouts. I'm the counselor for the Citizenship and the Nation Merit Badge. And what we do is we go line by line through the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And I show them where the Constitution was originally ratified by its signers. It was originally signed in the year of our Lord, 1787.
That's right.
And I just said, who is our Lord? And everybody said, Jesus Christ. Well, to say that this is a secular nation, that's not correct.
Well, I think you're getting the word out. Thank you so very much for doing what you're doing, Ron, and encourage others to do the same, okay?
It is a labor of love, sir.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless. Yes.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're running out of time. David, do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Yes, we can take back this nation if we have a groundswell of citizens willing to teach fellow citizens the truth about the Christian heritage and the foundation of our nation and the truth about what our founders intended to create a constitutional republic. Call 410-760-9068 to order your host kit, and you can host an institute on the Constitution in your church or community or even just for your family and friends to take our nation back.
Well, God bless you. Thank you for all that
you
do,
so
David,
much,
and give my best to Michael and his brother, and Michael, that's Michael Prutkin, his brother, and of course, they're the ones who are really put this together.
That's
anyway,
right.
Thanks very much
Thank
for everything you,
Dr.
you
do. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're interested in helping us and joining in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask about the Institute of the Constitution. And then, of course, if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, my March newsletter tells you the truth about the attack on Iraq, what it was really all about, not what you're being told by the controlled media or even by our politicians, but who really planned this, when was it planned, and was it to do with oil? Was it to do with Israel? Was it to do with trying to protect the dollar? Or was there another agenda behind this? And so our April newsletter deals with the background of the AIDS epidemic, and so does the May newsletter. And we're working on the June newsletter. We'll actually finish up this whole discussion, and you'll be able to have information that very, very few people across America really have, understanding why we have all these new diseases out there, why suddenly SARS is in all sorts of animals and monkeypox is in animals, and why the gorilla population of Africa is being destroyed by Ebola. Where did Ebola come from? Where did AIDS come from? Where did SARS come from? Why is monkeypox here? Why is West Nile virus now increasingly threatening our society? Well, we'll discuss all of those in the latest newsletter, but if you'd like a free copy of one of the newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WARN. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders. We ask you to pray for our ministers, because they should be leading this truly spiritual battle in which we're engaged. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, of course, they were not going to be able to preserve our freedom. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, our ministry, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with our listeners in the Great Northwest, of course, we do another hour here. You can listen to that on the internet at RadioLiberty.com. But if you're in the Great Northwest, we'll be back with you again tomorrow at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls because we're going to have a fascinating hour. Our guest tonight is Mr. Douglas Gillies. We're going to be talking about his book, Prophet, The Hatmaker's Son, The Life of Robert Mueller. And Robert Mueller was the Assistant Secretary General of the United States for many years. He was the secretary, he was really the most powerful appointed position in the United Nations. And, of course, he was born in Alsace-Lorraine in Europe. He spoke 7 or 8 different languages. He was looked upon by many as a prophet. And, of course, our guest this evening, Douglas Gillies, was born in California, raised in Ontario, Canada. He practiced law in San Francisco for the 16 years after graduating from UCLA, and he produced 6 documentaries, including On the Edge, A Wake-Up Call for the State of the World, featuring Mikhail Gorbachev, Jane Goodall, Ted Turner, Houston Smith, Orion Lyons, and Robert Mueller. And he began documenting Robert Mueller's life in 1994, first interviewing him for television and then producing A Passion, an audio cassette, where Mueller talks about the meaning of life and death. Mr. Gillies, of course, lives in Santa Barbara at the present time, but he's traveling, and, of course, he's trying to get people really concerned about these issues of the United Nations. How can we have world peace? Well, I think that's something we'd all like to see. We'd like to see the end to war. Of course, that is the basic theme underlying the belief of so many people who support the United Nations, and, of course, would just love to see the time when, of course, the poet wrote, till the war drums throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man and the Federation of the World. And that was the words of Alfred Lord Tennyson in his famous poem, Locksley Hall. And, of course, that really was a watershed event. It was written in 1842. And, of course, it expressed that desire to put an end to war once and for all. Well, we've had many, many terrible and horrible wars since 1842, and the question is, how will this ever come about until we change the very nature of man? So thank you very much for being with us tonight, Mr. Gillies.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, are you completely retired from law? Are you spending full time promoting this idea of a world rules or world law?
Well, I don't know if anyone can ever retire from law. You know, it's like riding a tricycle. Once you start doing it, it's hard to forget it. So I still am called upon time to time to give people advice. Mostly I just refer them over to other people, but I'm afraid once you go to law school, there's no turning back. They take your thinking and turn it around, and it's that way forever.
Well, I was a physician for many years, and once you're a physician, you're always a physician, even though I've been retired for some years now. So basically, how did you happen to meet Robert Mueller?
Well, I was hosting a conference in 1994, and he was one of the people who was invited, and I had never heard of him. I don't think he's a terribly famous man, but he responded to the invitation and sat through the conference, which lasted 3 days, and I could see that others who were there were moved by him. You know, he had a strong influence even without talking, and I became curious about that. And so at the end of that conference, I interviewed him, and I asked him, what do you think is the most important question now that we have to address in order to move forward and make the world better? And he said, without a hesitation, he said, the meaning of life and the meaning of death.
All right. Well, those are certainly very profound thoughts. The meaning of life, and but did he tell you what the meaning of life is? And, of course, what is the significance of death?
Well, you know, the way he phrased it, he said, at the United Nations, there's so much complexity. You're dealing with so many different things at once that one day you wake up and you just find yourself asking, what does it all really mean? And so he said it was a question that Hammarskjöld asked, it was a question that Utant asked, and so he said the question of the meaning of life is only part of it, because we also have to ask ourselves what's the meaning of death, because that's something that if we don't face it can startle us or can interfere with our clear thinking. Well, I had never heard anybody ask a question that comprehensive before. As I interpreted it, he was basically asking the question, who are we? What's a human being? What does it mean to be alive? And that was so far outside my own way of thinking that I became curious about him.
All right. Of course, I noticed that your book is endorsed by Ted Turner, Jean Houston, who was one of Hillary's disciples or friends, and Barbara Marx Hubbard, certainly names that are well known, at least to the listeners of this program. And they all seem to really believe that Robert Mueller has the answers, or at least is trying to approach the answers to how we will have a better world. So do you want to go ahead and tell the story of Robert Mueller? Because you start, you know, with him, of course, you start, partway through his life when he's actually asked to go to China by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Kurt Waldheim. But, of course, then you, of course, follow his life from his childhood in Alsace-Lorraine all the way up, of course, until the time of his retirement. So why don't you, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about this fascinating story of this fascinating man?
Well, Robert Mueller was born in a poor family. His father was a hat maker, and he was born in 1923. In an area that was a part of Belgium that was up for grabs. Germany had claimed it, and then Belgium, after World War I, said it was theirs, and the League of Nations was charged with the job of finding out who this region belonged to. And Robert just happened to be born in that region when it wasn't clear what country it was. So, in a sense, he was just born into the world.
And, of course, his grandparents spoke French one time and then German, and then they would keep changing their languages. The control of that area changed from one hand to the other. Is that right?
Can you imagine what that was like? His grandfather changed languages 5 times without ever leaving his village, because the Germans would invade, and then they would take Alsace-Lorraine, and they would teach the children German. So his grandfather's father spoke French, but he was taught German in school. Then, after World War I, it went back to France, and then during World War II, it was German again, and then it went back to France after the war. When someone grows up in a region in which nationality keeps flipping back and forth like that, I think that it changes their thinking. It would have to. You know, in the United States, we just can't imagine that. But in Europe, the boundaries kept changing, and people were told from moment to moment they had to change allegiances. And I think after a time of this, it started making them wonder if maybe this was just going to somehow have to end.
You know, having traveled to France, the great battlefields of France, and Luxembourg, and, you know, the battles of the First World War, the average American has no idea. You know, at Verdun, 400,000 Frenchmen fell, 400,000 Germans and Italians fell in that senseless battle. And you travel all over the countryside and you see these statues of all these men struggling, the beautiful statues, marble, and they shall not pass here. And, I don't know, 100,000 men fell in this battle and that battle, and you know, the legacy of the First World War, I'm sure, was fully, very much alive when Robert Mueller was a young man. And then, of course, after the senselessness of the First World War, then, of course, comes the Second World War. And, of course, I could see why many people in Europe really were championing the idea of a world government so we would no longer have war. I mean, that was really the major thrust. That was the thrust of the League of Nations, which failed because America didn't join it. And then, of course, we had the Second World War, and America joined the United Nations, or crafted the United Nations, really. But then it never really seemed to fulfill its promise either. And we see time and time again when there's strife, and the United Nations stands idly by, as they did in Rwanda. 800,000 Tutsis are slaughtered, and then, of course, they say, gee, maybe we should have intervened. Or as is happening in the Congo today, after 3 million people are dead there, now they've sent in a French contingent that seems to be mostly just sitting around and doing nothing. So I'm sure all of these things must have influenced, Robert Mueller to want to make a better world. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think it was probably the atrocities he saw when he was fighting in the French Resistance that forged his decision. He grew up with the history of World War I. His dad took him to Verdun when he was 16, said, it's time you saw what war is about. Because as a child growing up, Robert just didn't even want to think about war. And, of course, it was always on his parents' minds. So he went to Verdun, as you did, and it shocked him to see bayonets sticking up out of the ground that had never been covered up. Then to see the huge building in which 150,000 skeletons were stored. He turned to his father after that and he said, I think if any leaders want to start a war, they should have to come and meet in this building, and that will make them think twice about starting another war.
Yes, I've stood in that great mausoleum there on the hill, overlooking the Valley of Verdun. It is truly it's the experience I agree with you everybody should have, and we should ask, what madness was this that provoked that carnage?
It was almost as if the world had gone insane. You mentioned the Battle of Verdun, where 400,000 people died, and in that battle, which lasted 9 months, nothing changed. The line never moved. And even worse than that, all across Europe, the trenches were dug, and while 10 million people died, the line never really changed more than a half a mile or a mile here and there.
Right, and the senseless bayonet charges into machine gun fire, and again and again and again, this act was carried out, and again, why the people were slaughtered by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, and by the millions.
Now, I think that most young people growing up today don't realize that that was our recent history. I didn't understand it. Maybe you didn't either until you visited. We've always been somewhat protected by our oceans. We're not attacked in that way. And it's easy to forget. One reason I wrote this story was because I wanted to remember, and I thought it was a story that we should all remember, that time and again the Europeans went into these wars, and it was supposedly the most civilized part of the world, and they fought the most brutal wars of all. Robert, when he went into the French Resistance in World War II, wasn't a combat person. I don't think he hardly ever shot a gun. He wasn't a particularly proud person. He wasn't an athlete. But he was nevertheless called upon sometimes to act as an interpreter because he spoke fluent German, having grown up on that border. And right at the end, when the Allies were moving into Lyon, and heading up through France towards Germany in August of 1944, the resistance captured 20 young Germans in a barn. And the commander of the resistance asked Robert Mueller to get them to come out and surrender because he could speak German. And he said to them, you can trust us. What Hitler told you isn't true. We will not slaughter you. Just put up your hands and come on out. The war is almost over. Why get killed now? And these 20 young boys surrendered.
Were they soldiers? Or?
Well, they were kids.
Okay.
You know, at the end, Hitler was drafting everybody down to 16,
sure, right.
just fighting desperately to hold on. And then Robert went off for a day and witnessed the liberation of Leon. And when he came back to the encampment, he was told that all 20 of those boys were shot.
And of course, you know, why? I mean, what possible reason would there be? The war is going to end. Why take their lives? The Germans are not your enemies. The French are not our enemies. And yet, of course, in war, people do terrible and horrible things.
He went running across the camp and into the commander's office, and he started pounding the table, and he said, "Why did you do this? I promised them they'd go home." And his commander said, "While you were gone, some villagers came, and they said that there had been a funny fire in one of the farms, and they wanted us to investigate." So his commander said, "We went and took a look, and inside the barn, they had brought from Fort Moonlog, the Klaus Barbie prison, they had brought the prisoners and then burned them alive." And he said, "We saw skeletons that had nails through their jaws that were tied with barbed wire. And I took those 20 young Germans and showed it to them. And I said, 'Look what your Führer has done.'" And he said, "They didn't seem at all ashamed. They even seemed proud. And that's when I had them shot." And so at that point, Robert Mueller walked out and wandered off into a field, and he was devastated because he had been somehow responsible for the deaths of these young men. And that night he decided that for the rest of his life he would do everything he could to work for peace, that there just should not be any more wars, that humans had gotten to the point where they just couldn't solve their differences by killing each other. And he stuck to that the rest of his life.
And he's still, is he still alive?
He's very much alive. He's 80 years old. And we went back to the United Nations on his 80th birthday to release this biography. And you know, it happened to be the same day that President Bush had demanded that the Security Council pass the resolution authorizing war in Iraq. So we were there at a very interesting time, especially to be with a man who had pledged his life for peace.
Well, now, was Robert Mueller with you when you took the book in?
Yeah, we went together. He showed me around. We went up and down the halls and rode the elevators. We tried to hold a press conference, but the reporters were all in the General Assembly where they were debating whether or not to go along with the war. But somehow they managed to get over just long enough to take the sandwiches.
All right, fine. Well, I think that people have to understand that Robert Mueller was there during successive administrations and became really one of the most powerful men in the United Nations. You know, certainly the Secretary General is a figurehead, but it is the bureaucracy that really makes the United Nations run. And how long was he the assistant or acting, what was he, the Assistant Secretary General?
Well, he came from the bottom. He started off there as an intern in 1948, just making $300 a month. And then over the years, in working in social and economic programs, he was promoted. He actually didn't become an assistant secretary general until 1982, when Perez de Cuellar was made secretary general. And so he sat. He had that position for just 3 or 4 years. Going back earlier, at the beginning of the book, as you pointed out, I started in the middle of his career, and that was partly just to give a reader a sense for where this man was heading, because he was not terribly famous, and he wasn't really that powerful. He was always the assistant. And as I thought of it, he was one step out of the spotlight. He worked in mostly in the back corridors, just coming up with charts and graphs and trying to figure things out. But in the 70s, he became the person in charge of administrating all the UN programs, a very complex combination of social programs that were all over the world, and where most people were numbed by that job. It was so complex. Robert Mueller was able to thrive in that position. He was able to keep on top of it, and encourage the creation of more and more social programs to get food, for example, from the countries that were burning it to the countries where people weren't getting enough to eat. I think his overall method was to try to eliminate the need for war.
All right. Now, of course, he was basically trained as an economist, and that was his initial purpose there. He was very, very close to Euthant, and Euthant is one who brought him to a key position. Euthant was actually a Buddhist, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
All right. And, of course, didn't Euthant then lead Robert Mueller into a more of this Buddhist type of outlook on the world?
Well, no. Yes, I guess so. I mean, Euthant would say things to Robert, like... He said, I don't understand. He said, I'm a Buddhist, and so we don't really even believe in God, but I practice being spiritual from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep. And he said, and you're a Christian, and you practice, and you believe in God, and you only go to church once a week. And so they would have these interesting conversations because they were from such different worlds.
But of course, my understanding of Robert Mueller's beliefs more or less corresponded in many ways with those of Alice Bailey and some of her disciples, more than the true, at least mainline Christian beliefs.
Well, I've never heard him talk about any of that. He was a Catholic, and while at the UN, I think his thinking generalized because he began to realize that there were people like Euthant, a Buddhist, like the Hopis in the Midwest, like the Hindus in India. He kept meeting people that had different points of view than he did. And so he kept trying to broaden his perspective so that he could encompass those different viewpoints in his own evolving sense of what the world was and who he was in the world. The thing that he read, because I interviewed him quite extensively about his youth, because I wanted to know how he came to think the way he did. And the strongest influence that I could find was a writer named Emile Coué, who went around in the 20s lecturing about the power of positive thinking. And he'd tell people, you get up in the morning and you say to yourself, that this is the best day of my life. Every day I'm getting better and better. And so it was the precursor, I suppose, of all sorts of popular seminars and therapies nowadays. But of course, he was just the person that was starting this, so it was a pretty simple idea. But Robert took that and has practiced it all his life. And his mother taught him. Because she was a teenager when Germany went to war in 1914, and she saw what happened to the people in her community, and she became very suspicious of groups, and she always told Robert not to join any groups, because if you join the group, then they'll just take something away from you. Always be an independent thinker. And so I don't know if he ever really he was born a Catholic, so he stuck with that. He tried to see the value of all of the other viewpoints that he came upon in the UN. But he still goes to Catholic Church. He'll still go to Mass when I see him in Santa Barbara. He'll go to the old mission, and I guess maybe it's like lawyers. Once a Catholic, always a Catholic.
If you ever read the World Core curriculum, now he actually has come up with a World Core curriculum for education, and of course it's taught in a number of schools throughout the world. Have you ever gone into that, the beliefs and the things that he teaches there?
Well, I asked him how that started. Where did he come up with the idea of a World Core curriculum? He said back in 1977, somebody asked him if he could give a speech about education in the sense of a global perspective or something like that. And so he gave a talk. He hadn't really thought about it, but at that time he pointed out that when he was raised, he was taught as a student of a French school that everything was French, and he got French history and French geography and French literature. And then when he was in his last year of high school, the Germans came in and took over, and they said, everything the French taught you was wrong. It's all lies, and we're going to keep you here for an extra year to tell you the German point of view. And then they taught them German history. So he came away from that thinking that they were both nuts, I think. So in asked how to teach, he said, well, I think in order to teach geography, we should suggest to the child that first and foremost we're in a universe. And then within that universe we're in a galaxy. And then a solar system. We're on a planet. We're on a continent. And then it's a country. And a community, a province or a state. And then a community. So that they'll understand from the large to the small where they are physically in geography. Rather than how it's normally taught, which is starting with the town and moving out. That's in keeping with his thinking, which was really, I guess, most influenced by Descartes. When Robert was in high school, he had a teacher who taught them to think according to the Cartesian principle, which is that when you deal with a problem, you try to encompass all of the pieces. Don't just work on a part of it, but make sure that all of the variables are considered when you try to find a solution to the problem. And so as a young man, he started trying to practice that way of looking at things. And so, yeah, Descartes influenced him. Schiller influenced him. Émile Coué. As for Alice Bailey and that, it might have come along much later, but by then he had seen so many things from so many parts of the world that I think it would have just, if it affected him at all, it just would have fit into it.
Have you read his book, the Woman of the World or something of the
sort? First Lady of the World, yeah. He wrote that as his wife was dying. He wrote it in a tough time. And dedicated it to her because she had been such a strong advocate of treating men and women equally, and so he thought, well, what if a woman was made Secretary General? What would that be like? And so he wrote that story really as a farewell to his wife.
It was really a very interesting, very touching story of giving, I think, tremendous insight into Robert Mueller. And although he doesn't appear as such, you know very well that he's who he's talking about.
Yeah, he's he went forward from that. He went to several women heads of state and said, "Have you ever thought about becoming a Secretary General?" He really would like to see a woman be Secretary General, if nothing else, to see if that would make things work better.
All right, fine. Of course, now, of course, he has a lot of very strong feelings about how the United Nations should supervise disarmament of the world. And it's a wonderful dream, that every nation would disarm. But, of course, what happens if a nation doesn't disarm and everybody else does? That's sort of like, in society, if you disarm the peace-loving people and the law-abiding people, but the criminals don't disarm,
yeah.
Then, of course, you have a chaotic situation.
Right, and we can't have that. Well, it was Costa Rica that first decided to disarm, and they just decided in 1948. You know the story of Costa Rica?
No, I don't, and I think maybe our listeners might enjoy it.
There was a military coup in Costa Rica after World War II, and when that happened, one person was in France, and he came back, and he started organizing for an overthrow of the military government. And when he succeeded, he decided that Costa Rica should be the first country to abandon its military. Are we running out of time?
No, we're going to the half hour break.
Okay.
So go ahead, and I'll let you know when we have to catch things short.
So he said if we were to stop spending money on soldiers and arms, then think how much money we could put into education and healthcare. And so in 1948, Costa Rica adopted that idea, and several other countries have followed suit.
Well, we're going to have to interrupt you there. We'll pick it up in just a moment when we get back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I guess this evening is Douglas Gillies. He's a retired lawyer, or maybe a semi-retired lawyer, practiced law for 16 years. His book, Prophet, The Hatmaker's Son, The Life of Robert Mueller, is a fascinating insight into this man who played such an important part in the United Nations for so many years. Now, how can people get copies of your book?
The first place I would suggest is our website. It's www.eastbeach.org. They can get it at Amazon.com. In Santa Cruz, there's two or three stores, Capitola Book Cafe. Downtown, let's see, what's it called? I've forgotten because I couldn't
remember. Oh, is that the Santa Cruz bookstore?
No, a bookshop. Santa Cruz doesn't have it yet.
Oh,
we're growing into the stores, but...
How about the Gateway Bookstore? Would that have it?
Gateway.
So that's the metaphysical bookstore down on Pacific Avenue.
Good. I'm glad you remembered because I had forgotten the name of it. Yeah.
Oh, right. Fine. No, I get down there not infrequently. Okay. Well, if you have any questions at all for our guest, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, you were telling us about Costa Rica. And so Costa Rica then, of course, gave up its military. It does have a police force, though, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. You know, they have a police force. And they had to take the risk that the other countries would invade them. But what they found was that the other countries saw it to their advantage to have a country that was not armed. And so if one country started to encroach, then others would tell them to back off. And gradually other countries in Central America followed suit. And so now we don't have the endless wars that we used to have. But you raised an interesting point, which is that if everyone just lays down their arms and somebody holds on to their weapons, then that gives them the opportunity to take over. And we can't let ourselves get lost into that abyss. I think we all want to be in a world someday in which people just don't kill each other. Why should we do that? But we have to go in that direction wisely, and we have to do it together. And then we have to have some sort of a police force to watch out for the renegades and the real criminals. I think we'll always have to deal with that.
And I think that's the problem. Until we actually can somehow change the hearts of men, why, of course, there are going to be difficulties. Well, we've got Jeannie calling in here. Hi, Jeannie. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I've got a question. On Robert Mueller's wife, I read that book also.
The First Lady of the World, right.
And it was dedicated to her, but as I understand, didn't she have Alzheimer's, and he was concerned about that when he talked about that in the book?
Yeah, he actually wrote the book while he was sitting at her bedside,
mm-hmm.
And it was awfully sad, because when he finally retired, they were hoping to travel, and it was right at that point that it began to surface that she had Alzheimer's.
Now, how old was she when she passed away?
Well, let's see, that was 92, so she would have been, 71 or 72, I guess. I'm not sure on the math.
Not too old, then.
Not too old, but, you know, that's not that uncommon, I guess.
Well, now, go ahead.
Yeah, I live part-time in Central America, and so the question I have for you is, how is Costa Rica now and the crime rate and so forth without guns?
Well, you know what happened was when I first went there in 95, CNN had just come in. And so all of a sudden they were starting to look on television and see what was coming across our media. And as that was happening, they began to have more and more problems. It's still noticeably peaceful and safe relative to other Latin American countries that I've been to. But they are very challenged, I think, by Western, not Western, but what is it? You know, commercials that tell them to stop, to drink Coca-Cola rather than orange juice. When I was there, you could buy fresh juice just almost anywhere. There were stands all over the place. And I've heard since then now those stands aren't there anymore. And people, rather than drink the juice, they drink the Cokes, and the fruit just rots on the ground. So they're going through some kind of an adjustment as their appetites are increased or at least changed by television.
And I think television is really is a great scourge. I lived in South Africa for a time before television came in, and it was amazing, you know, living there. And then, of course, when television came in, why the whole society changed, and we witnessed that. You know, and it was really so pleasant being there, not having television. And the high point of the evening was when they, on the radio, they would read a Wilbur Smith novel, or I've forgotten the names of some of the other people that, you know, very, very famous English adventure stories. And you're, you know, instead of having to worry about these violent, sex-laden pornography, studded programs that we see now, why, of course, the programs, I think there was a fellow named Hammond who's a writer there, and really it was a wonderful, wonderful life. And then the television came and it all changed. Anything else you want to say, Jeannie?
Well, as I understand, throughout Central America especially, there's a lot of drug problems, such as in the United States, and the drugs are being supplied to the young people, so that will decimate the young generation. I have another book by Robert Mueller, and it's a small one. It's called The Birth of a Global Civilization. And he wrote this in 1991, and he actually has a chapter where he did a an address delivered at a conference, and he called it Seeking the True Meaning of Peace. And this was at the University for Peace in Costa Rica in June of 1989. But as I was reading it, I was a little surprised that he is a Catholic, because I was looking at what he was saying in this speech. And he says, "We are a living earth. Each of us is a cell, a perceptive nervous unit of the earth. We are earth alive, and are beginning to be connected about the earth. The living consciousness of the earth is beginning to operate through us." And
that sounds very much as the New Age, almost the pagan ideas. When you were analyzing Robert Mueller, did you run into any of these beliefs of that sort?
Well, as we were nearing the end of the story, I knew from the early times that as a child he was very influenced by his walks in nature with his father. He felt I guess it was, you know, there was a story when he was a kid. He lived in an apartment that had a garden, and then they moved to another part of town that had nothing at all. Nothing was growing, and Robert was about 5. He got very discouraged. So one day his dad took Robert and his sister out, and he showed them a cherry tree covered with cherries. And he said, "I bought the crop of this tree for you, and you guys can come here anytime you want and pick as many cherries as you want." And that left a very lasting impression on him. Now, rolling forward, when I was finishing the book, and I showed him the final chapter, and there's a moment where he's deciding whether or not to leave France once and for all and go to the United Nations. And he talks with his family. I won't give it all away, but for those that might read this, you want a little bit of surprise at the end. But as he finished the conversations with his family, I said, "Is there anything else that happened? Or was that when you made your decision?" And he said, he thought for a minute, and he said, "As a matter of fact, you're right." He said, "After that, I still wasn't sure whether I should leave home. And so I went for a walk back in the forest where I used to rainbow as a kid." And he said, "Something happened to me there. When I was in nature, I felt like I was more alert and more intelligent." And he said, "I think that's because we come from nature. We're material. We grow out of nature, and then when we die, we go back into nature." And so he was thinking about this. He said, "I think that's why it was. But once I was out in the creek, it wasn't as if I asked nature for the question to be answered. But when I turned around to come back, I suddenly realized I knew what I had to do."
So that he really has this sort of tie to nature, even more so than to the Catholic perception of God, would you say?
Well, I think he carries them both. Certainly living in Costa Rica for the last 15, 18 years, has had an influence on him because it's a tropical environment. He lives in a cloud forest, monkeys nearby and magnificent looking birds and waterfalls and things. So in his final years, starting with 1980, when did he go to Costa Rica? 1988 or 9. He's brought that more into his life, I think. I don't think it was so important when he was in New York City at the United Nations.
All right, Jeannie, do you have another question to come in?
No, it's interesting to get his background.
All right, fine. It really is a fascinating book. I'll tell you what, I'll let you read the book if you'd like.
Well, I gave it to you, Dr. Steve.
Oh, did you give me the prophet?
Well, not the prophet.
No, this is what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
No, you gave me the other book, and I appreciate that. God bless you. Thanks so
Bye.
Much. Okay, fine. If anybody else has a question or comment, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And certainly Robert Mueller was one of the men who helped to shape the United Nations to be what it is today. In fact, you had actually included with your book something that Robert Mueller had written about. Of course, he's talking about how we have to adopt all these various international treaties, and U.S. must ratify the United Nations Land of the Sea, but that, of course, will actually, of course, make it relinquish a great deal of its national sovereignty. And then he talks about, of course, the Bootland Report and several of the other international, report that was made by the German foreign minister, the Brand Report, the Bootland Report, and others, though. He wants us, of course, to following the path-breaking reports of the eminent persons on North-South relations, the Brandt Report, on disarmament and our common future, the Palm Report, on environmental development, the Bootland Report, three future groups of eminent persons are established. And so basically, of course, he wants all nations to transfer their sovereignty to the United Nations. Do you think that will ever come to pass?
Oh, no. But I think that you're reading not from Prophet, but from a plan that he took to the UN called Peace Plan 2010. That's what sounds familiar.
Yes, that's written what it was. It
yeah.
came when I got the Prophet.
That's something he put together just in order to go to the UN at the time that they were being asked to declare a war. But those commissions, you see, what he often did was when a problem started to surface, he would beat the drum, meaning that the UN could bring people together so they could talk. And then when people come from all over, sometimes they start to see a pattern that they might not have seen from their own corner. So when he speaks about eminent persons, it's not like a government or an institution. He just means let's get our smart people together that know about this thing and see if they can come up with anything.
Well, of course, you know, one of the great champions of this United Nations and this whole movement is Mikhail Gorbachev, and yet he's never renounced his communist background, has he?
No, I think he's probably always going to be a communist. I don't know, though. He's an enigmatic character because he's the only person I know in history who actually launched a revolution that was almost without bloodshed and brought down an empire, and it was his own empire. I think probably he grew up believing in communism, because if he didn't, he wouldn't have been made the head of the country, and maybe that's still the case. But I think what happened to him was that when he began to realize that the environment was deteriorating, he could see that the Cold War was blinding at least the leading countries to the fact that something else was going on that was much more serious. And he didn't tell me this, but somebody else suggested that he was willing to surrender in the Cold War so that the world might then wake up to the fact that there was something else going on that was much more serious.
Have you met Gorbachev? And
I interviewed him once in 1995 in Washington, D.C.
All right, and of course, you know, he certainly seems to have made some very, very powerful allies, you know, with Stephen Rockefeller and Maurice Strong, and it seems like such a strange situation where the former head of the Soviet KGB, the man who led Russia, at least during part of the Afghan war, that senseless of war that was there, and then, of course, becoming the dictator of Russia, he would be on such good terms with such powerful and representatives of the international capitalist community, people like Stephen Rockefeller and certainly Marie Strong. Doesn't that seem a little incongruous to you? And I realize we're a little bit away from the Robert Mueller, and yet, of course, these are the men, of course, Robert Mueller, I'm sure, was well acquainted with.
Well, the Mueller had not met Gorbachev, I don't think, because you see, he was on the economic and social side of the UN. He was never in the political affairs. That's one reason most people have never heard of him, because he was never out trying to negotiate truces. So I don't think he ever met Gorbachev. Certainly, he's known Marie Strong over the years, and I think Mueller and Strong, you know, see each other with a grain of salt. I don't think they see eye to eye on everything. But of course, Strong. Well, one distinction was that Strong went to the United Nations as a delegate from Canada. I'm pretty certain, and Robert went to the United Nations as an employee of the Secretariat. And when you go to the UN as a delegate, you're there to be a champion for your country. When you go as a member of the Secretariat, you're asked to work on behalf of the United Nations and the world as a whole, rather than as an advocate of your own country's interests. So their careers kind of, well, they were inconsistent, because they came with different portfolios.
Well, as we look back throughout history, there have been many attempts to have a world government. Certainly we find this under Nimrod back in the days of ancient Babylon, and there have been other people who have tried to create this a unified world, whether it be Alexander the Great or the Caesars, or I don't know whether Napoleon ever had any aspirations of that size, but of that sort. But certainly at one time, England controlled a third of the population, a third of the landmass of the world. Certainly Russia controlled a third of the landmass of the world at its height. But Robert Mueller is one of the people who really believes we can unite the world under common rule.
Well, I think he has a great appreciation for the diversity. And yet, at the same time, he realizes that we need to be able to get together and figure out our common problems. Like, how do we decide how many fish to take so that there's always fish? If one country, like the United States, pulls back, and another country, like Japan or Norway, just go ahead and fish, then it doesn't work. And so there are all sorts of things now that we have to face together. Rain falls on the planet regardless of borders. So don't we have to sometimes get together and say, what about fresh water? You know, how are we going to be sure there's enough? And what do we do if a company comes in and buys all the water and then tries to turn around and sell it to the people that used to own it?
But that's exactly what's going on in America today, when we see these major international corporations coming in, buying up the water systems, which are really, in effect, monopolies, and then doubles or triples the water rates. This is really happening.
Oh, it's outrageous, and people won't stand for it. You know, one thing that tells me a lot about Robert, I only know him as well as I can by talking to him, but he's never in his life owned a share of stock. Isn't that interesting? He was a hat maker's son, and then he went to the UN, and he started out at $300 a month, and he never dabbled in any of that. You know what distinguishes him is he's just not greedy. And what you see a lot of nowadays that is so offensive is greed has become a driving force. I don't think it was always that way, was it?
No, well, it sort of depends on the individual. I think that there's always been a certain desire for to improve one's life and improve the life of our children. But, of course, if it's greed without any sense of compassion or concern for our fellow men, if all we would do, as the libertarian says, you know, is practice selfishness because that's the most effective form of society, why we've lost sight of what life is really all about. There has to be compassion, concern for our fellows, as well as a desire to look after ourselves. One cannot exist without the other, or you'll end up with a moral anarchy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we're at a time now where we have to keep telling each other that so that we don't lose track of our values.
Well, what do you foresee? You've spent a lot of time interviewing Robert Mueller. You've actually had an opportunity to put on conferences with Mikhail Gorbachev. I guess you've produced six documentaries, including On the Edge, a wake-up call, featuring Mikhail Gorbachev, Jane Goodall, Ted Turner, Houston Smith, and Robert Mueller. You've had a chance to talk to these people, people like Ted Turner, you know, the tremendous wealth that he has. Where are we going?
Well, Ted Turner said something that we put in our program that guaranteed it would never get on television. Ted Turner said, and he was very serious, he said, we need to consume as little as we possibly can. And then he said, of course, you know, I fly a jet. But he says, but, you know, he understands that there's a lot of contradiction, but I think he was coming right down to it. We have to consume the things that we value, and not just take as much as we can, because if we do it, then others are going to want to do it. They're going to see it on television, so they're going to want to do the same thing. And it doesn't seem to make people happy.
Well, but of course, Ted Turner, I mean, he talks a good line, but he's one of the biggest consumers in the world.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly one of the richer men. I don't know how much he consumes. He says he likes to spend about half his time out on his farm just riding a horse. Well, you were asking me a very good question, and I'll try to answer it, and it's a challenging question. I believe that people are able to solve their problems if somebody doesn't get in their way. And I think that we're going to come to terms with this much more complicated world. It's a lot more complicated than it was when I started growing up. But when I watch people get together and try to wrestle with the problem, they usually come up with an intelligent solution. So something's getting in our way, but I don't think it's human nature. I think the UN has done a lot of good because it's a place that people can come and talk. I don't think they've been that successful at negotiating peace, but because I don't think the warring countries have wanted peace very much. Rwanda was a terrible tragedy. But I think we're going to sort ourselves out. I think we're going to have to change a little bit, and maybe ask ourselves more often what makes us happy rather than what satisfies our latest urge. I think television and advertising has changed us, but only on the surface. I think underneath we're still the same people.
When do you think men are basically good, or do you think that they're basically evil?
Well, you know, I've met some bad people, but not very many. I guess I have to go on my own experience. Most people, when I sit down and really pay attention, I think are good.
All right, fine. But then, of course, when we have bad people, sometimes don't these people actually aspire to positions of political power? Can we really look at Washington, D.C. today and say we've got a lot of good people there working selflessly for the good of humanity, or do we see a lot of people there who've gotten there by power and, of course, by running roughshod over others so that they will have the power to not necessarily help the populace, but to aggrandize themselves?
You know, well, I find it very hard to believe that that the best that we can do is what we're sending to Washington. I think we can elect better people.
Well, no question about that.
But you know, the other thing is that we were lucky that our Constitution was framed by people that understood the government always tries to take power, and so they built a system in which there was at least competing. You know, three competing branches of government for that power, and then build that on top of a constitution, knowing full well that people will have to always, always protect their liberty, because when power concentrates in government, it always seems to get out of control. And I think we have a good model. I think our federal model, where there are states, but there's also a federal system overlaced with it, is the best system anybody's come up with, and maybe somehow we can figure out how to adapt this system so that the world can function like that. I don't know.
I certainly tend to agree with you. That's the only solution for Iraq today. I mean, you've got too many different factions there. The only system that would work would be a federal system not based upon one man, one vote, other than in the individual areas. And then, of course, in the federal system, you'd have something like you would have within our Senate, where, of course, you'd have two senators from a little state like Rhode Island and two senators from a mammoth state like California, and each one of those senators' votes would be exactly the same. And, of course, people say, well, that's not democratic, and that's exactly why they set it up as they did. They did not want a democracy because they knew that power would eventually be misused. They wanted to limit the power of the central authority. It's such a shame that the average American doesn't understand the foundation of our freedom, or even the lessons that our founding fathers had learned and incorporated into the Constitution. Because, you know, most of our politicians have never read the Constitution. I had a friend of mine who talked to 100 lawyers, you know, all graduated from law school, and only two of them, who were both taught by the same professor, had ever read the Constitution.
I wonder if I had that professor.
No, he was a fellow named Herb Titus, and he taught in the East. So did you read the Constitution when you went to law school?
Oh, yes.
You did. Actually, the Constitution, not what people said about it.
Oh, yeah, you have to read it, and it's not that hard to read. It's pretty straightforward stuff. Something you said a minute ago, it really stimulated me. It was, it's this. You know what? You can tell our system is still functioning because people just are not going to sit still for the Patriot Act. They're saying, hey, you know, you can't tell a librarian to report what books people are borrowing. We won't go along with that.
You know, I think that's so interesting. In fact, somebody just handed me the name of some fellow here in Santa Cruz who's organizing to make Santa Cruz a USA Patriot Act free zone. And, of course, I'm sure he's on the far left. And I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think that every responsible American should rebel against this. Because, of course, as you well know as a lawyer, they're not using this on terrorism. They're using it on everybody they want to.
And those politicians didn't even read it when they passed it. They
right.
just were reacting to 9/11.
Right, and, of course, we're going to have to get the people informed and educated and realize that there are people in Washington, D.C., and some of them, I'm talking about people like John Ashcroft, who has the support of the Christian conservative movement, and yet he is totally abusing his power. And I think that in many respects, he's one of the most dangerous men in America today. Anybody who would quote Bobby Kennedy's statement, talking about the mafia, I don't care whether, if they spit on the sidewalk, I'm going to arrest them. That, of course, is total misuse of power.
That sounds more like Singapore than the United States.
It sure does. Well, anyway, it's been a fascinating, fascinating time. Our guest has been Douglas Gillies. His book, Prophets, The Hatmaker's Son, The Life of Robert Mueller. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, first of all, I appreciate what you said when I called you earlier. You said, I'm on the air 5 hours a day because I want people to think. And I think that's the very first thing, is we all need to use our own brains and figure out for ourselves what's going on. I probably should have told you the 800 number for the book. Because
go ahead, put it out.
It's 1-800-942-7617.
Now, say it again. You have to learn. On radio, you always say it three times.
It's 1-800-942-7617.
And one more time.
1-800-942-7617. Oh. And thanks for having me on the show.
It's been
really
a real pleasure to have you. And if you're going to be around for a few days, give me a call. We'll go out to lunch.
Hey, that's good.
Okay, God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just wanted you to hear this. And I thought it was a fascinating insight into a man who's, of course, studied the life of Robert Mueller. And, this is the time we ask you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders and our ministers. Please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.